Wednesday night edition of the pod. Danny, we have peace in our time.
Yeah, I'm very excited that we might not have to use the Dan Feldman. We had a deal. I'm hoping that we don't have to use that for this.
Yeah, and hopefully this will last a little bit longer than when Neville Chamberlain proclaimed peace in our time, which it appears that it will. The union and the league have released a statement saying that an agreement in principle on the new CBA has been reached. The agreement will go for a guaranteed 6 years beyond this season. And then there is a further season with one that has a mutual opt-out, which means, of course, that it won't get exercised. But we basically got 6 years of labor peace. That's almost exactly the amount of time that we had for this one. And some of the new details are coming out. We, of course, have discussed a lot of this to quite a degree before. Go back to the end of October. I did a whole podcast, like an hour and a half, with Larry Kuhn on what some of the things that had been reported were. A lot of those have come to fruition. There have been some more details. So just for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to focus exclusively on the things that have been reported, confirmed today. I'm sure there will be a lot more stuff. And then, of course, we'll react to that as well. So, Danny, get us started here. What's been reported?
To give themselves a little bit of leeway, because the opt-out date was a month from now. The opt-out date was now. They extended it to January 13th to allow a little bit more time, but most importantly for ratification. And an early piece that is very encouraging, though not perfect for me, is that they are shortening the preseason with the intention of lengthening the amount of time of the regular season, which will reduce back-to-backs and, I would hope, eliminate 4 games in 5 nights.
Yeah, and I think that should be possible. There's definitely been actually some controversy in the news, which we'll get to, this thing with Cleveland resting all three of their best guys on the way to Memphis today that we can talk about. It's not going to shorten the number of games. It is going to give guys more rest. I wouldn't anticipate that this will have an enormous effect on the amount of time that guys are getting rest, but it may have an effect on guys getting hurt just a little bit less, seeing a little bit better quality of play. We'll see about that. The next big news, probably the biggest in terms of what is going to affect how the league's going to operate, is veteran extensions. These have now been changed. The previous rules, you could basically, if a guy was in the last year of his deal and it had been 4 years since he signed his previous contract or extension, if he's in the last year of his deal, you could basically sign him for 3 more years. That was not very attractive to players who could sign for 4, even with another team, or 5, re-signing with their own team if they reached free agency. That was a big problem with guys leaving. KD, he might have signed a more lucrative extension. Dwight Howard, Kevin Love, those guys might have wanted to stick around. LaMarcus Aldridge, same thing. And now they're going to give teams a better mechanism to do that because now players can be extended for up to 4 additional years. And even in some circumstances, if they meet certain criteria to be a designated player, they can be extended for 5.
I wish they'd used maybe a different term, just because now there's going to be confusion with a designated veteran and a designated player if they leave it in. But fixing,
yeah, maybe it will be different. Who knows?
But yeah, I hope
that's
it
how
will
they're
be.
Catching it now.
And it's also a true with the CBA that a lot of the common parlance is not actually in the CBA, and so we can try to do a better job of framing the conversation. But to get into the crux of the issue, the extension system was the biggest failing of the 2011 CBA, and while we don't know all of the details, what we've heard so far is very encouraging to make it a more palatable, workable system that doesn't have the pretty terrible for small markets unforeseen consequences that the 2011 one did.
I still think there are going to be some issues. One of them is that you're going to be limited in the type of extension you can sign if you get traded. And yeah, that might make it more likely that players will extend initially, but for players who want to leave and already say that they're not re-signing, especially if you think of it as a player like on the order of a Rudy Gay, right? Like, he's not going to re-sign for the max deal, the max number of years after this. And so Sacramento would like to get something for him. And if they trade him and then they can't, then he can't extend in an extension that makes sense once he gets traded. Now the Sacramento can't get anything for him either. And so I still think that that issue may not be resolved. We'll see what the exact language is. This is one of those things where guys are writing right now on deadline. The stuff's getting leaked to them probably in like text messages. That level of nuance probably just isn't out there yet and isn't really understood by people outside the process. So I don't want to say, hey, this is for sure not going to be fixed. Based on what's out there, though, I have a little bit of skepticism. The other thing that I have skepticism for is that this issue, as Zach Lowe and Woj reported, that just like for the Rose Rule, certain performance criteria, including making an All-NBA team, Defensive Player of the Year, Most Valuable Player, are going to be required to be this designated veteran extension. And you know that we hate all that. It was ridiculous that Anthony Davis couldn't get as much as he should have because he didn't make All-NBA last year just because he happened to be hurt. You know, we'll see. Maybe the criteria are low enough where it's not like you have to make it twice in your first 4 years in your rookie contract or something where it's not going to matter as much. But I just really dislike having it based on basically a popularity contest in the media when you have team employees, for example, voting for guys. Now there's going to be even more incentive, by the way, for the team employees to do that. So I don't like that. I think they could have found a better way to deal with that. But, you know, this is what the league is driven by, is a lot of this media stuff that no one says they care about except, oh yeah, it's incredibly important for all this.
I dislike both of those, and I want to tie in another player. You brought up the Sacramento Kings and Rudy Gay. I'm concerned about this deal for the Sacramento Kings and DeMarcus Cousins, because I understand that it's a desire to have him able to sign a deal with Sacramento that he can't sign anywhere else because of the idea that, you know, you give an incumbent advantage. However, that substantially curtails their ability to trade him if he decides he doesn't want to stay. And that is also strange in terms of player movement and creating inequities in the system. And so again, like in 2011, they may have done this with the best intentions, but they could be creating they're creating a loss of value for the incumbent team if a player chooses to leave.
Another thing that's interesting that is not clear, but this is me trying to read between the lines. We've talked about with the max salaries, how there's a certain amount you can get if you're 0 to 6 years experience, 25% of the cap, essentially 30% of the cap if you're 7 to 9 years experience, and then 10 plus, you can get up to 35% of the cap. Zach Lowe tweeted out that these new designated player extensions, the salary in year one of an extension can be up to 35% of the cap. Now, I don't know if this designated player extension, that means you can only get it if you have 10 plus years experience, or, which would be my favorite way of looking at it, is you can get it earlier on because that matches up much better with when players are actually good earlier in their career. There's not very many players who are worth a super max. In fact, other than LeBron James and maybe Chris Paul, that's nobody in the league right now who's worth a super max with more than 10 years of experience if they become a free agent at that time. So we'll see how that ends up playing out as well. Other interesting news here, David Aldridge reporting that the new max salary for 35% is going to be start at $36 million, and then the 7 to 9 years experience will start at 31. He didn't say the 0 to 6. By my calculations, though, if those are the two for the two higher brackets, then the 0 to 6 would be about $25.8 million to start with. And so then what would that be for the max contracts if that is where we start, you know, over a 4 and 5 year period, both re-signing with your own team and then also if you were to change teams?
So if you are a 10-year vet, you could sign, if you re-signed with your current team, you could get up to 5 years, $207 million. If it was new team, 4 years, $153.7 million. Then for the 7 to 9 year slot, which is what Kevin Durant was in this year, that would be 5 years, $178 million, or 4 years, $132.4 million. And then for the 0 to 6 non-Rose Rule, you know, Harrison Barnes, let's say, that group, you could get 5 years, $148.5 million, or 4 years, $110.3 million with a new team.
Yeah, and obviously, if you're signing with a new team, you can only get 4.5% raises. You re-sign with your previous team, you have bird rights, 7.5% annual raises. So that increases it a little bit more even than just getting the extra year. We have not
and
heard
that, and that ties in with one of the interesting questions that's still out there is, so Aldridge got those numbers, which are compelling, and it isn't entirely clear exactly where, because that is different than what you would see the numbers at with the current cap estimate that's out there.
Yeah, my $103 million. Yeah.
Is that the difference is because with the expanded definition of BRI that they expect the salary cap to go higher. That is my expectation. Or they could have just agreed to a different salary cap for the first year. They're allowed to do that. So that's probably it. They could theoretically have changed the calculation for max contracts. That is another interpretation if you're taking his numbers as gospel, and I think that's a good working thing considering he got that reported to him today. So it can go in a couple of different directions. We won't know. This is another example of the detail that we won't know for sure until we get the actual text, but it's worth noting nonetheless.
Yeah, and Aldridge noted in his piece that players will get a larger percentage of some revenue streams. There's some talk about luxury boxes for other events at the arena or arena signage, basically just expanding the idea of what's basketball-related income, BRI, and even if the players are only getting 49 to 51% of that, if you expand the definition of BRI, that's a win for the players. Zilgit did have a tweet that I had a little trouble making sense of, which was basically that the expanded definition of BRI will help both the players and the owners. That doesn't make a ton of sense on the surface. My only thought, and I'm not an expert on this, is that maybe there's something in that definition that's going to help the owners from a tax perspective, as far as like being able to write off it more. But maybe if there's some listener who knows a lot more about this tax stuff than I am, they could weigh in on that. But that would be the only way I could think of that expanding the definition of BRI could help both sides, because obviously what the players get more of, the owners get less of.
One thing I'll mention is that I know that I've gotten a lot on this also partially due to my connection to the story and the Warriors part of it, is that the possible increase in max salaries increases the distance between what Kevin Durant could sign for using non-bird rights and the max. When I wrote a piece for the Sporting News on this in October, that difference was about $1.7 million. If they didn't change the non-bird calculations, that difference is about $4.2 million now, but we don't know everything yet, so I'm not speaking definitively. And if you want to know a lot more about that, today's Locked On Warriors, the first half of it is about this, interpreting it from their perspective.
Yeah, in summary, if Durant takes a $4 million haircut, they can pay Iguodala and Livingston whatever they want. If he doesn't and he demands his full max, then they probably can't keep those guys, is basically what it boils down to. Other things, the over 36 rule is now, in Woj's parlance, a 38 and under rule, which is interesting. That basically makes it the over 39 rule now. So if that's in fact wasn't just a typo. So there used to be a limitation. You essentially could only do a 3-year contract, 4 in some circumstances, when one of the seasons would encompass a season in which the player was 36 or over. Now, coincidentally, because Chris Paul and LeBron James would both be eligible for 5-year contracts that they couldn't get because the over 36 rule, it's now the over 38 rule, and now both of those guys can get those 5-year contracts that'll be over $200 million whenever Chris Paul will be a free agent this summer. He can get it. This also probably increases the chance that he stays with the Clippers, by the way, being able to get that 5 years, that they now will have the advantage to keep him. That will almost certainly be a horrible contract by the end of it, but that's the way it works, and this
was a rule that should change because players are aging better now than they were before. So, you know,
I haven't actually seen any evidence that that's true, that players are actually aging better than they used to. I mean, anecdotally, yeah, but and maybe that's true. I mean, I guess there weren't any guys.
KG was more productive even at that point because he was, what, 38 when he retired? 40?
Yeah. I mean, I guess in the 60s, no one was playing until they're 40. Like, then nobody ever made it past like 35. But since like the 80s, you know, Robert Parrish was playing pretty late, Kareem, like those guys, John Stockton. So we'll see. Maybe that there is some evidence of that. I just haven't seen it yet. But I actually kind of don't like it, in the sense that I think it's just giving all the money to players who already are veterans and have been in the league forever and don't really need it. I mean, if you're just trying to, like, from a utilitarian standpoint, like, make more people happy, giving it both to players who are really good but younger, or to players who are kind of on the lower end of the salary scale, it makes a little bit more sense. But, you know, that's where the power is in the union. And so from a utilitarian standpoint,
if you're going to impose individual maximum salaries that only affect the best of the best, I think it's moderately fair to say that they can get a little bit on the back end.
Another thing, Tim Bontemps, among others, reporting that rookie scale contracts and all salary cap exemptions, and he said all salary cap exemptions, I assume that's going to be the mini mid-level in addition to the minimum, the mid-level, the biannual, that all of those are going to move up. He reports it'll be about 45% for next year. So what you would have in those cases, the MLE would start at about $8.4 million, and you could do a 4-year deal for $35.9 million. for that. The mini mid-level, the taxpayer mid-level, that would start at about $5.2 million. You could get a three-year deal there for about $16.3 million. And then the BAE used to be about $2 million. Now that's going to go up to $3.3 to start, so you could get a two-year deal, almost $7 million there. And then the room exception used to be 2 years, $6 million. Last year was the most you could get. Now you could get 2 years, about $8.8 million for that. And it'll be interesting to see. This might enable some players, just because the money is higher in absolute terms, to just go where they want to go more often. And it just, those exception salaries have become so uncompetitive with the cap rise. And the other report is, of course, that these are now going to be tied to future increases in the salary cap as well, which I think makes sense, as will the rookie scale.
I'm a big fan of that last point because it makes for a more workable system. It would have been a lot better to have that in place for this year, but having it that way moving forward in case revenue changes, and because having it as a part of the structure means it's more likely to be a part of future agreements now that they've already figured it out, and because that forced everybody to think about where these lines should be moving forward. Because, you know, if you're saying on relative terms the mid-level is going to be this moving forward, then you hope that they took a little bit of care to make sure that that line is a reasonable line.
Yeah, actually Larry Kuhn just posited something about the max salaries that I saw. He noted it used to be the max salaries were computed on an old version of the cap that was about 2% of BRI lower, and he noted that the $103 million cap, those maximums that we talked about, the $36 million for 10 plus, $31 million for 7 to 9, those are almost exactly 35% and 30% of the $103 million cap. So maybe just the 35 and the 30% will just be actually correct now. You don't have to do this weird multiplier, which always made it difficult and confusing anyway for people. And I've probably put everyone to sleep even just talking about it at this point. So that actually is probably the simplest explanation for why we are where we are. And then it'll probably take a while for those estimates in terms of like the larger BRI definition to really get baked into the cap estimate. So we may see a new cap estimate come out, but the more I think about it, that seems to make more sense, because it would be hard for them to know and have done the projections yet of like how that was really going to affect things to the point where it's actually like getting leaked out. They probably have their own internal projections there, but I wouldn't expect that to be out there yet. What else do we have here now?
The reporting about two-way contracts is in there a little bit and how that ties in. So Tim Bontemps said that teams are now going to be able to have 14 players under contract. My interpretation was that might be active because the line is 15, but then the 16th and 17th roster spots can be these two-way contracts and that they can get paid. Their pay will shift based on where they're playing.
Yeah, the fact that they have to have 14 players under contract, that means at least...
Oh, it's the... Okay.
Yeah, sorry. What did you
no,
say?
No, I was... You were clarifying it. I was realizing I might have misstated it.
Yeah. So you have to have 13. This is per Tim Bontemps as well. You have to have 14 now, which makes sense, as you're going to create another guaranteed job. Almost all teams in the league right now have 15 players anyway, because they realize with how flush they are and nobody really up against the luxury tax, that those are good developmental slots you can get a cheap good player out of maybe. And then these two-way contracts, there had been a report earlier that was not wrong, I want to say, but maybe unclear, that D-League salaries were going to $75,000 to $100,000. That's not the case. It's only if you're on the two-way contract and you're sent down, you're $75,000 to $100,000. I think the rest of the D-League salaries are going to be, you know, remain relatively low. Another small things here that we can just take in turn. There had been reports that they were having difficulty hammering it out this late hour because of an issue with the licensing of player images. The NBAPA basically paid a flat fee to the NBA to do that for them. And then now the NBAPA is going to handle it themselves. They were able to work that out. There will not be an amnesty clause. There shouldn't be. There's not any change to the salary cap rules, the luxury tax rules, to where, you know, someone would be taken unawares by that. And I think that's about it. Oh, the age limit. Yeah.
There was a little bit of movement. It sounded like, I think Aldridge was the one who reported this, about the idea of the players would have liked a 0-2 compromise, which is that a guy can come out of high school, but if they go to college, they have to stay for 2 years. But that ended up not being a part of the agreement. They're going to keep the same thing. And then the other one of significance, we don't know all of the details yet, but Mark Stein reported that the window for matching or passing decision time on a restricted free agent went from 3 days to 2 days.
What would you think of the 0 and 2 if that were to be implemented? It looks like it's not going to, but since they haven't, you know, if they're still going to be negotiating on this point, but what would you think of that 0 and 2?
I like it better than the current rule. I don't think there should be any restriction, but letting those guys go out in that way is a good thing. And I wonder how they would interpret that for European players and a lot of other things, but for American players, I like it better.
Yeah, I think for European players, you could probably still go at any time. There being some sort of like, oh, if you're 18, you can go, but if you're 19, you can't. And if you're 20, you can. I mean, the whole point of it, I think, is just to more protect colleges and allow stars to develop in college and get exposure. Neither of those really apply to European players. So yeah, I would like that. I mean, I still think that high school guys should be in it. It makes our job harder. It makes NBA teams' jobs harder in theory, but you know, you're still going to screw up in the draft just as much. You know, you're still going to draft Buddy Hield at number 6, even if you've got 4 years of college film on him. So,
One other piece of significance before we kind of close the door on this, Tom Haberstroh reported that the NBA and the PA agreed to a new wearables committee. So they're going to, for biometric data, they're going to try to manage and regulate it. It is a big issue for a lot of different reasons. And that's a step in the direction of, you know, more openness, but we'll see what that committee ends up doing.
Well, I don't know if the contract goes for another 6 years, but for the time being, at least, NBA players wear Stance socks, and I own about 15 pairs of them. They've been a sponsor of the podcast twice now, so some of them they sent to me, but a lot of them I just bought on my own because I think that they're just fantastic. Just a great way to kind of lounge around the house if you you know, go work out. They're great for that too. I really like playing in the game socks. I've got a pair of the Noche Latina socks, which really look good, have awesome patterns on it. I've got a pair of the Bulls game socks, the Hawks game socks. People always think they're kind of cool when I play until I actually start playing and get injured. And then it's not, that's not the socks' fault. That's my body's fault. But until then, at least I look good when I get out on the court. And they also have great casual stuff for the NBA fan too. I love all of their old retro team stuff. What are some of your favorites of those, Danny?
There's a lot of good stuff. There was the Clippers ones. I think I remember when we were looking through them originally and just went, oh my God, those are really beautiful. There's some great Miami Heat ones.
I have those actually. I bought those after that.
Yeah, the Bulls ones are great with the old script.
Yeah, the Nuggets ones are really cool too. Sonics they even have as well. Just really great retro casual stuff. Those ones are only $14 too. Those are actually really cheap. And the NBA ones, great moisture wicking, like padded. I never get blisters. In those, I used to get blisters all the time with regular socks. Really just a great way to go from boring, which is what socks used to be, to really a cool way to express yourself if you're an NBA fan, especially the retro stuff. I think is just really, really stylistic. So go check them out, stance.com. And it's not only the NBA stuff too, they have a ton of Star Wars stuff. Danny has what Star Wars ones do you have? I forgot.
I have they call it the droid socks, so it's C-3PO and R2-D2, and then I have the Yoda socks, and I also have a pair of Outcast ones, which I saw in their store one day when I was just looking around, and I love those too.
The droid socks is pretty funny, actually, that one of us would have that, and then one would be Yoda. Who's Yoda and who's like the droids between you and me? I feel like I'm probably the droid.
Yeah, I think we kind of bounce between the two, but I would ride on your back, so I guess that makes me more the Yoda, so...
Yeah, and I am tall with like kind of a stiff gait. I can kind of be C-3PO. All right, let's move on here to a little bit more news. The big thing that was in the news today was the Cavaliers, after Marc Gasol rested last night in a blowout Cleveland win against the Grizz, the home and home, LeBron James, Kyrie Irving, Kevin Love didn't even go to Memphis for the back-to-back. Gasol played. Grizz, I think, won pretty handily. And a lot of people were up in arms. One guy at the games had a sign excoriating them because he paid $800 and drove 6 hours for 4 tickets. These are one of the Cleveland and Golden State are the two most expensive tickets usually in most of these cities. And obviously fans buy in advance. And I think they feel justifiably aggrieved. I think that this is a problem if you're going to schedule the game, that it would be nice to see these guys. The NBA is a star-driven league. But to me, it's not, oh, the players are wusses, they should sack up and play. It's winning the championship for good teams. The better winning strategy is just to not play these guys, and that's the result of the system.
Their obligation is to their team, and their team's obligation is, as I interpret it, is to win as many games as possible to reach whatever level of success they want. And, you know, teams teams shut guys down too.
Like, it's not like they're like, oh, I really can't play today, Doc. Like, you know, that's not how players think.
No, they're being, a lot of times they're being shut down by the coaches, and it's a proper thing. Greg Popovich has done this for years. It certainly helps. You know, we've seen fewer injuries with them from what I can tell. And it's also just in terms of maintenance, a lot of the teams that employ this are expected to go a long way into the playoffs. So the cumulative fatigue physically and mentally is a big thing. And it's a lot easier to tell a player that he's not playing at all than to say, oh, we're putting you on a 20-minute limit arbitrarily or something like that. And it's a lot easier for a coach because the coach can just have them not dressed instead of playing it by ear. And then the coach, if the game's close in the third quarter or the fourth quarter, goes, oh, well, I can't play my star because they're only playing 20 minutes tonight.
Yeah, and players have noted too that it's not necessarily the minutes, but the games. That's LeBron James specifically said that. And to me, the people... The two analogies came to mind because everyone wants to complain about, oh, you know, back in my day, Wilt played 97 minutes a game and it never missed a game. And even in the 90s, you know, Jordan played all 82 every year. And yeah, the game was a lot easier back then. And you weren't playing, the game is much more demanding. We didn't have Sport View from back then, but there's just the level of intensity, especially on defense, where you have to crash down into the paint, get all the way out to the 3-point line. You have to guard so much more space. Guys are in much better shape. If you aren't resting, you're going against guys who are more rested and have more energy. And just guys get muscle injuries. Like, that's what the science has shown. There are people who study this stuff for a living and have advanced degrees who determine that you're more likely to get injured at certain times and when you have certain workload, and it's better to rest guys. And so to me, it's like, everyone's like, oh, well, they're healthy. Why are they resting? Well, do you wait to change the oil in your car until your engine breaks? Like, no, you perform maintenance. That's what this is.
That's how the human body works. I mean, you want to do that because it mitigates greater damage. And my frustration with this, and as writers, you know, it can be frustrating for us too, because we want to talk about these games, and the mutual non-aggression pact between the Grizzlies and the Cavs in these two games made both of them boring, you know, made both of them less interesting.
Yeah, we did. But I was going to watch that game and I didn't watch it for our analysis today. Like, right. I understand the problem.
But the frustration shouldn't be with them. It's that there are too many games in too small a time frame in a demanding sport. This is different than baseball, where you spend a lot of your time standing around and there's very little contact. You know, there's
the people rest in baseball all the time, and people complain about, like, you know, do we don't have 4-man pitching rotations anymore, right? Like, because the determination was made that pitching 20% less actually, like, helps pitchers stay healthier. And yeah, there used to be a time when people would pitch more, but they got injured more often back then. Or maybe now there's more intensity on every pitch and you're more likely to get injured. I mean, no one is like, oh, well, because these guys are pitching in a 5-man rotation instead of 4, like, now I'm not getting to see these guys. I paid for my ticket. I mean, I understand baseball and basketball have a lot of differences between them, but other sports, when guys rest, or European soccer, where guys rest, you know, in the domestic leagues, if they're playing in a European competition on a good team, we don't see this outcry. And yet, for whatever reason, everyone wants to decry how everyone is so lazy in the NBA.
The solution here, if there is one, would be to play fewer games or play them. And you can't really do that by lengthening the season. They added a week, as we talked about earlier. That's not enough time to eliminate back-to-backs. And the reason why that doesn't happen is because both sides would lose money. I don't know exactly how much money, but if the players get about half of BRI,
I'm not convinced that they would. Like, I would like to see a study. I mean, the NFL doesn't play 82 games. They make way more money. Like, the reason for that is that each individual game makes more money. Like, it could be that the scarcity would cause ratings to go up. I mean, I recall that ratings in that shortened lockout season were actually pretty good. But that said, there's certainly an understanding. I don't know one way or the other, but I would like to at least know whether that's been studied.
I would too, especially because I think there are assumptions. And if those assumptions are a little bit out of whack, the assumptions are what matters right now. So it would be great to have knowledge instead.
Yeah, or at least a projection that has some sort of an empirical basis other than simple subtraction. My last point on this, LeBron James was pretty awesome in the finals last year, wasn't he? And weren't the finals really awesome because Kyrie Irving wasn't hobbled and then broke his knee? You know, I wouldn't say that Kevin Love's injury the year before was necessarily generally wear and tear related, but those guys looked awesome and they were rested and they were ready to go. And that's part of why the finals were so awesome, that LeBron James had the energy to get up and block Andre Iguodala's layup at the very end of a game seven and play 44 minutes a game or whatever it was during that series. Yeah, I'm sorry. Like, it's too bad in Memphis, but I would rather see an awesome finals and have these guys ready. And it should be noted that really part of the reason this season's been awesome so far is like none of the top 20 players in the league have been hurt.
Yeah, it's a huge point. And this is a star-driven league, not only because the league markets it that way, but because when you watch a lot of it, that's how basketball at this level in particular works. I mean, it's the same in college. If you're doing that, and the players and teams owe it to themselves to put themselves in the right position to succeed. So until you change the inputs and the goals, you're not going to change that sort of a situation.
All right, let's get to some of these games here. We'll do a little bit quicker of an analysis, both because we're kind of tracking down some of this labor stuff, but also just because we're a little bit shorter on time this time around. I want to start with Philly and Toronto. The biggest intrigue in this game to me was Okafor and Embiid starting together for the first time. It actually worked pretty well because they started Valanciunas and Siakam for Toronto. And then Philly got out to a pretty decent lead, a couple of points over that first 6 minute stretch when they played together. And then in the second half, it was pretty close to tied. Toronto went on a nice run at the very end of the first half. They started Patrick Patterson against that lineup and then just killed them.
Yeah, it explained why you don't play two traditional bigs together, because you can exploit it by going small.
And Okafor was able to have some success. I thought that he individually had a pretty decent game at times. I kind of turned away once it got to be a 15-point game to turn to some other stuff. Robert Covington was great in what ended up being a Raptors comeback or a Sixers comeback. Towards the end, he was 10 out of 20 from the field. That was good to see. Okafor had 17 points on 12 shooting possessions, 3 assists. He was passing it well. He had 2 block shots. Was only negative 7, which wasn't too bad. Embiid did not have one of his best games. He had 4 turnovers. Did have 5 assists in this one, though. Like, he and Okafor were both passing quite well. He got 8 assists combined out of those guys. Was impressive. Embiid also had this ridiculous block where he went to double in the post, stopped a Kyle Lowry drive, jumped, Lowry shoveled it to Siakam, and Embiid with a second jump just packed Siakam's dunk attempt. Like, and he did that a couple of times. Like, his quick reaction, second jump, his rim protection, even just his instincts as far as like closing out, like he was the one that they had guarding, you know, the stretch four type of players when both those guys, he and Okafor, were in together. And Embiid is slow. That's not the best use of his skills, but he actually has really good instincts with communicating, knowing where to be. It's remarkable how good he is given his lack of experience.
I also really liked the pass that Okafor made early in the game. He actually got in good position, got the ball, but realized that Gerald Henderson was more open, made a little bit of an overhead pass, and Henderson was wide open and drilled the three. And that's the type of pass he's going to have to make when he gets good position and then has to make a decision.
Yeah, for the Raptors, Siakam was minus 12, Patterson was plus 16. I was glad that Casey actually started Patterson in the second half. Probably won't stick with that, you would imagine, but it's good to see nonetheless that he at least was willing to do that in the second half, be a little bit more open to it. And Scola as like a vet versus Siakam, I think Scola was obviously the starter last year. He feels a little bit better about making that move at that point. We didn't see Bebe in this one. He had a sore knee. Jakob Poeltl only played 7 minutes. So they really were going a lot smaller. They used Siakam as a backup center at times as well in this one. And Valanciunas actually played 34 minutes. The big story was DeRozan too. He had 31 points in only 30 minutes, 11 of 18 from the field, 9 of 11 from the foul line. He probably got fouled 4 times on mid-rangers. The Sixers broadcasters are very reserved, but you could tell they were kind of going nuts about how often they were fouling him on the mid-range, but he was hitting those shots. And then you kind of contest. And as we talked about with him, he has this beautiful job of making sure you don't contest too hard, because you're going to just get called for a foul with his pump fakes and with his ability to draw contact when he's in the air.
He also had one of the 2 real highlight dunks in this game. He dunked on Jahlil Okafor. And then the other one was Terrence Ross, after missing a windmill dunk last week, making a windmill dunk in this game, which was nice little vindication.
The one that he did on Okafor was just like right on his head. Like, yeah, like, and he kind of like started off with the Euro step, went up all casual in like semi-transition, like he was going to just lay it up. and Okafor is getting ready to kind of stick his arm out away from the basket and try to bother that shot. And then all of a sudden the ball was like bouncing off of his head. It was nasty.
DeRozan has some of the sneakiest best dunks because when he starts his move, you don't see it coming.
He goes so slow, right?
Yeah. Like remember that one he did at Oracle where I think he tried to do like a 360 in traffic or something crazy like that. And I didn't even realize what had happened until he finished.
Oh yeah. Oh, that was in the US game against China, I think.
You might be right.
Over summer, yeah. The Raptors still did give up $114 to the Sixers. Their defense is not good. It hasn't been good. But ho-hum, the Raptors, through three quarters, had a 133 offensive rating, and they still remain the best offense of all time by points per possession that we have measurements for. Pretty incredible what they've been able to do. And the Sixers just had no chance of stopping these guys whatsoever. And there's really the Sixers also managed to pull a Warriors and give up dunks at the end of both the second and third quarters, despite the fact that they took a shot with 5 seconds left in both of those quarters. That was a pretty impressive weak effort there by them. And I got retweeted on that observation by Keith Pompey, the veteran Sixers beat reporter. You know, that and like not being able to get the ball inbounds after timeouts, he just like goes crazy about those things with
good
Sixers
reason.
Team. Oh yeah. I enjoyed that. It's sort of like just the veteran beat reporter just like on press row shaking his head at like those sorts of little things. Like it never fails to get me.
I think we should move on to Washington. Charlotte was, I ended up watching this game back and forth with some of the other ones and watched a lot of it late, because what happened was the Hornets went on a little bit of a push. They ended up being up 10. I think it was late in the third. And then Washington came back, took the lead, and then almost blew the lead, but then ended up holding on and winning it by 3, 109-106.
Yeah, John Wall was excellent down the stretch in this one, had a couple of tough shots. He hit his signature elbow jumper going to his right, and then I think he hit one more jumper that put them up 6 with 30 seconds to go. And Charlotte was able to play the foul game and get a chance to hit a 3 to tie it, but Kemba Walker off an offensive rebound. First, he traveled to get out behind the three-point line, threw it up, and it went in and out, luckily for both the officials who didn't call the travel and for the Wizards. I think the biggest takeaway here was 15 points on 12 shooting possessions for Kelly Oubre. He is pretty solid with his long arms getting the passing lanes, had a couple of steals in this one, although not as many as John Wall, 7 steals to go with 8 turnovers. That would be an interesting stat of like players who had 7 or more steals but also had more turnovers than steals. That's got to be pretty rare, you would think. But Wall still, of course, had 25 points as well on 23 shooting possessions. That was solid. He had 10 assists. But the biggest thing for me, what I started talking about, was I think the Wizards are starting to find something here with this lineup with Oubre at the four and the rest of their starters. Over now 61 minutes, that lineup has a 35.8 net rating, and we'll see Markieff Morris miss this one with a sore left foot. That's why Oubre played the 40 minutes, and Morris has not been good with their bench either, and their bench, of course, was terrible again tonight, per usual, although Jason Smith scored well. Maybe we'll see that, like, will that more of that unit. I mean, the starting unit for Washington still is pretty good. They've played 384 minutes, 7.1 net rating. You can tell how much Scott Brooks is searching, because outside of those two lineups that I mentioned, the next highest unit on the team, only 49 minutes so far this year.
Since I know you're going to love this, I actually looked up your question. And there have been 4 occurrences.
I knew I was droning on for a long time for a reason.
Yes. There have been, before tonight, there have been 4 occurrences since 1983-84 of a player having 7 or more steals and having more turnovers than steals. Gary Payton in 99, Dwayne Wade in 2009, Russell Westbrook in 2012, and Robert Covington, of all people, in 2015.
Yeah, one of those things is not like the other. But yeah, other than that, that's sort of like your list, a list of all guys who are high steal guys and high turnover guys, and also kind of high assist guys as well. So that is really interesting. I mean, I guess you would have to have a Sixer on that list, right? From this recent vintage.
By rule. I'm a little bit surprised Michael Carter Williams isn't on it.
For the Hornets, Steve Clifford blasted his team's effort and their softness. They have really been in a tailspin of late, and they have been healthy these last couple of games as well, getting very little out of anyone on their bench of late other than Marco Bellinelli, who shot well this year. He had 16 points, 4 of 6 from three, but Kaminsky continues to really, really struggle from the field. Roy Hibbert did not attempt a field goal. 2 free throws was all he had in 18 minutes. And yeah, you know what? Like, this team is a little bit soft, you'd think, although, you know, Marvin Williams, Michael Kilgilchrist, like, they're not supposed to be soft, those guys. Williams is working back. He continues to really struggle. He's been awful this year. He has like a 7 PER coming back from that knee contusion. And Kilgilchrist was okay. We're actually going to talk about him in the mailbag tomorrow. If you happen to listen to this, put in a question for the mailbag. You can, I've tweeted it out a couple of times. And Kemba has kind of fallen back to earth a little bit. He only had 17 tonight, 9 assists, you know, totally good game, but not like the all NBA level of games that he was having for the first month of the season. And we cautioned that maybe if he wasn't going to be that player, this team could take a step back.
Jeremy Lamb has had single digit points in 3 of their last 5 games, including just 2 in 11 minutes tonight. I like Lamb in certain circumstances, but he doesn't duplicate Bellinelli in skill set at all, but I don't love playing them together. And so if that's basically the 2 and the 3 in your bench unit, it's not my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah. Also infuriating to Clifford was 18 turnovers. They really avoid turnovers on this team. That was a big problem for him. What else do we have here? We should at least mention that Larry Nance dunk over Brook Lopez that I would have to imagine will almost certainly be our dunk of the month on the next, like, this
yeah,
dunk.
Apologies to DeMar DeRozan for having a really nice dunk and not even being the dunk of his own night. But
oh yeah, like, Nance, if you haven't seen this, like, look it up immediately. He crossed up Anthony Bennett, got to about the dotted line, took off of 2 feet. Brook Lopez was there, like, way out from the rim too. Like, you'd think, like, there's no way he's going to be able to dunk this because Brook Lopez chest was pretty far out and he's huge. And so Nance just contacted him, bounced off him, just kept rising and just threw it through. I mean, it was I think easily the dunk of the year, I would say, right?
His elevator just kept going up. Like that,
right.
When I knew it was a nice dunk before I saw the vine the first time, and I couldn't believe that it happened because it was different. I love the Victor Oladipo dunk and Zach LaVine on Alex Len. This was a completely different universe in terms of quality of dunks because of the degree of difficulty.
In other news, I think the Lakers have now lost 9 straight. Are they either 10 and 18 or 10 and 19, something like that?
I'm guessing you didn't watch the end of this game. It was one of the more heinous things I've seen in the NBA this year because neither team could make a shot.
The last 4 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, because at one point, the Nets were up 6 and each team kept on getting clean looks. Even both teams missed free throws. And I think there was about a 3 or 4 minute stretch where no shots went in and a lot of lazy, sloppy turnovers and all that. And these are two teams that are still finding themselves. Jeremy Lin did not play in this game, which was disappointing, would have made it more interesting. But the Lakers are in a tailspin of sorts, but it is in many ways, it is more regression to the mean. And it reminded me a little bit of, so last year, early on, I was very skeptical of the Knicks and said, you know, I think it's going to fall apart. Knicks fans got all chesty about it. Things happen. Yeah, same basic thing happened with the Lakers this year. Yeah. They'll be better. They're much better than I expected. That's still true, regardless of what's happening now. But they're not as good as that early stretch was.
Yeah, Lakers are 10 and 18 now after this loss. And that's a game that if they were actually any good, like you probably should win. I mean, I know Brooklyn's had some okay wins at home, but without Lin playing, it's not like the Nets shot 38%. This was a very fast-paced game, but they did get to the foul line for 40 attempts, and then they had 19 offensive rebounds. Trevor Booker was outstanding in this one. He had 18 rebounds and 8 points. He's actually quietly having as good of a year as you could hope from Trevor Booker. Another game that I watched a fair amount of was Oklahoma City and Utah. That's probably the one that I watched the most. And we talked about this on the Twitter NBA show. In many ways, this was a repeat of Oklahoma City's loss last night that we covered against Portland. It was just a lot slower because the Jazz play slow. But the final damage in this one for the Jazz, very, very slow game, only 86 possessions. And the Jazz put up a .109 on them. So that was a 127 offensive rating, 67% e-field goal goal percentage. And Oklahoma City just could not score, could not get into the paint. They, or when they did, they were just being completely stymied, mostly by the likes of Rudy Gobert. Jeremy Grant, in particular, just puts his head down, goes to the rim, and misses the layup every single time with four guys on him. Westbrook in transition, this is something David Locke noted. He, I think, was 4 out of 6 in transition, but the Jazz really punted on the offensive glass, tried to get back. And other than a couple of plays where Dante Exum drove and scored, and then he was guarding Westbrook and couldn't get back, and Westbrook got and ones, they really kept him out of transition. I think Westbrook was like 3 out of 19 in non-transition situations, and Westbrook's efficiency continues to crater of late.
They'll be in trouble as long as Oladipo's out, and I didn't expect him to be that central, but any shooting is good shooting for them.
Westbrook had 27, but he was 7 of 25 from the field, only 5 of 6, only 6 rebounds in his 31 minutes, and didn't play all that much in the fourth quarter with the game essentially out of reach. One of the more enjoyable things, of course, is Enes Kanter's return. He had 19 points, 6 of 11 from the field, 7 of 8 from the foul line, and of course was negative 9 because the Jazz just went at him in pick and roll with Derek Favors, and Shelvin Mack was the ball handler. Not exactly like a murderer's row with Favors in his first game back. Good to see him back out there. He just played at backup center, didn't start. But Shelvin Mack was just like driving past Kanter and scoring on him at the rim over and over again. So Utah fans got to boo, and they got to see a nice victory for their team. And really, other than Kanter, nobody who took more than, I guess Steven Adams was the only guy who shot over 50% for the Thunder.
A broad lesson to players is if you are, particularly if you're playing on a team that is the only team in their entire state, probably don't badmouth them on the way out because they'll remember that.
And for the Thunder, you know, they had to start Robertson and Grant at the 2 and the 3 in this game. And that didn't go too well. They finally actually went to Nick Collison, who led a brief run, or I should say facilitated a brief run at the start of the third quarter. At the 4, he started the second half actually instead of Sabonis, and of course Oklahoma City's bench got completely destroyed. Westbrook was only -6, and then, you know, the rest of the bench, Samaje Kristen, for example, was -20 in 23 minutes
despite making a 75 footer, and they tried offensive savior Kyle Singler, didn't work.
Yeah, Barinas was terrible last night, so they decided to give Singler a chance. By the way, how terrible must Josh Huestis look to them if he hasn't, even with all their wing problems over the last 2 years, even been able to get like a single minute, essentially?
Hey, they picked up his option for next year, so they have to like him at least a little bit.
Well, if you don't like him enough to play him over Singler, I mean, Singler is getting to the point where you almost would like, I mean, I guess they're keeping him on the roster just in hopes of maybe trading him at some point, but he's almost getting to the point where it's like, hey, just stretch the guy, like get someone else on the roster, because like they don't really have any guys that are even promising at all, D-League type of guys. I guess maybe they thought Kristen fell into that category. And who knows? Like, I suppose it's possible that the return of Cameron Payne could really help them. You imagine that he'll probably play a lot with Westbrook, in fact, just because they don't have anybody else who can play the two. But for right now, Oklahoma City, they are under 500 on the road, haven't played that many road games either, at 15 and 11. This could be a downtrend for them. I'd be interested to see what their schedule is. But they certainly have really, other than that one win at the Clippers when they defended like crazy, they couldn't score in that game either. They just have not been able to score at all against good defenses because they just packed the paint and they can't hit a three to save their lives, especially with Oladipo out.
In a piece of good news for the Thunder, I saw it from Royce Young, but Brian Davis apparently said on the broadcast that Payne is, and quote, a few days away from rejoining the team.
Well, rejoining the team and like traveling with the team, because Royce was skeptical about that, I think, in a subsequent tweet saying that, you know, he's not doing anything right now other than just,
oh yeah, dead, you're right, I hadn't seen
shooting.
That
yeah, so I mean, I think it's still gonna be a while for him, and given their previous experience and the fact that he's already rebroken that Jones fracture now, and it already happened to Kevin Durant, you have to imagine like they're gonna be incredibly conservative with him. But hey, the best thing to happen to the Thunder today was that the extension rules, it sounds like, will probably enable them to extend Russell Westbrook again without him reaching free agency. So that's that at least is in their favor.
It is.
All right, we done here? I think we are. Aaron Gordon had 33 points, a career high today in that Orlando Clippers game. Again, I didn't get a chance to see that much of it, but I was able to just watch all of his shots, and he was very effective in the minutes where he was playing with Jeff Green at forward. Vucevic did not play in this game. due to a sore back. And Serge Ibaka got into foul trouble in the first half, so then they went with Green. And Ibaka is a floor spacer too. And Gordon, part of why he was able to be so good is he had like 7 or 8 dunks in this one, including like a beautiful reverse alley-oop. He had another one where he drove to the basket, missed a finger roll, and then before anyone even knew that the shot had missed, he had pogoed off the ground again and dunked it home. It was really an incredible play on the drive. And he also was able to hit some shots, coming off of screens for threes, hitting a couple of open threes, as well as jump shot. He's looking more comfortable taking it, still only at 30% coming into tonight, but maybe there's a little hope there. He still can't hit a free throw to save his life. He shoots like 50% on free throws so far this year, which is a concern for his three-point shooting, but an encouraging game for him. And not only because he was like playing more of the four, which he was some, and he was getting out in transition, and that was how he was able to be effective, but he did do a nice job in some of those outside players things that we hadn't seen much from him. I still don't think that's the right position for him, but give him credit, at least on this night he was able to be effective there.
Thrilled for him. That was a great night. I'm sad that I missed it. I might end up like you watching some of it at a later time, but great to see him have a good night, especially when we were less charitable to him when we did the prospects, both the podcast and the Twitter NBA show post show.
All right, we done here?
I think so. I'll plug, it's not out yet because I'm still editing it, but I did a podcast with Eric Corrine, who writes for The Athletic Toronto, about the Raptors, a team that I've been fascinated with this year. That should come out tomorrow afternoon. That's my hope. It's not all the way done yet.
Yeah, did he have some good stuff to say on like why their offense has been so ridiculous?
Yeah, we talked about that and the success of the Lowry plus bench unit, and also the status on a lot of their young guys, because their team, other than Siakam, that they haven't played a ton of them. So I was just wondering how they're doing and how everything's going with DeLon Wright and Pirtle, who actually played tonight, and those type of guys. So we talked about that too.
Yeah, they do have an intriguing stash there still. Twitter NBA show will be back on Thursday of next week. We have Clippers Spurs in that one. The Spurs will be looking for some revenge after LA just destroyed them at home in November. And then of course we'll be doing the Christmas games on the Twitter NBA show as well. And I think that's about all we have. We're going to be back with the mailbag tomorrow, so keep an eye out for that. We'll talk to y'all then, and go check out some Sans socks. I think you have until December 20th that you can order them and still have them get there for Christmas. Great men's and women's socks. So check those out. Everyone that I've ever known who's had them, my girlfriend, me, Danny, even some other people too, who I can't think of right now, all of them really like those Sans socks. And I think you'll really enjoy the designs yourself. We'll talk to y'all soon.